The Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. We have a full agenda, members, and I also like to announce that we are being televised today. You look good, Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have one bill on the agenda today, and then we have four presentations. And I would just like to, since this is our first bill, we've been hearing from agencies the past couple of weeks, that at least the process that I would like to use is the same process we've used in this committee in the past, although I'm open to discussion on this. But for bills that are going to say in this committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, it's my intent, unless we have differences here, that the chair or the vice chair will basically lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So we won't be voting on those bills unless the bill needs to travel to another committee, and then we will have that motion and that re-referral. So I want to set a consistent policy so we're not, that's the way this committee has functioned in the past. I think it's worked well. And then as we move down the line, hopefully we'll have a fair amount of consensus on what ultimately ends up in that omnibus bill. Are there questions about that? Representative Smith and I discussed it. Representative Smith, that is the way we have custom and usage in this committee anyway, has been in the past.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it did work well. The committee can, under the chair's guidance, can do it that way. It did work well, and I think it's a good idea to continue. I would have one question. I know the makeup of the public safety end of what the legislature does. In the previous session, the Public Safety Committee, as it was configured, comprised both finance and policy on crime. Perhaps I can raise this question later, but I think it would be good to maybe visit the question, since the current makeup has finance and Chairman Mullery's policy. Will the bill, or will it not, or does it need, or does it not, to be heard in that policy committee as well?
Representative Smith, if the bill has policy in it, it should go to Representative Mullery's committee first and then come here. I suppose we could have situations where it might go back to that committee if there were concerns about that policy, but it was my hope that all the policy issues would be resolved at that level, and we would deal primarily with the fiscal matters in this body, in this committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The procedure you outlined about laying it over, chair laying it over, is a good one. It will work. I think each bill, as we look at, perhaps we should just keep an open mind to having an additional hearing and a policy venue, whether it's had one, if it has not had one before it gets here. I think that issue should just be a present issue on each bill that we look at.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Any other questions about the process I've outlined? If it looks like it's going to be problematic, or if we're, you know, we can always revisit this. Okay, with that then, just keeping that. Representative Tao, welcome to the committee. You have an amendment. It is my intent to lay House File 56 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And you have an amendment, 56A1. The chair will move that amendment to get the bill in the order that the author wants. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Tao, do you want to introduce the bill and your guests?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is not a new bill. You have been in this committee before. It was presented last year under Representative Smith. Essentially, we're asking $500,000 to combat a pretty brutal crimes that's been committed by these gangs. Essentially what happened is you have a couple young runaways, particularly girls, 12, 13, and they would take off for the day, and they need a warm place to stay, so they end up staying in this some guy's place, and he introduced meth. Most of the time it's meth. There's some other kinds of drugs to these young girls. And then they get up the next morning, and he says, well, the meth wasn't free. You have to pay for it. And then they don't have any money, and so he says, well, you have to prostitute for me to pay off the meth. And he continues to give them meth. And eventually these girls end up in this very vicious cycle. And everything's underground, I take it, and it's underground. There's a network of it. Essentially, this bill is to penetrate those underground networks and try to free some of these girls. And so I have Officer Straka. He's an expert in this field, and he's an expert in the in crime and gangs in the Hmong community as well, and he'll explain a little bit. So,
Officer Straka, you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Rich Straka. I'm a sergeant with the St. Paul Police Department. I've been a police officer for 21 years, 7 with the Minnesota State Patrol, and the last 14 with St. Paul. My expertise is Southeast Asian gangs, primarily Hmong gangs. I've been involved in learning and investigating gangs for about 16 years right now. I've investigated everything from petty theft all the way up to homicides, gang rapes, everything involved there. I'm currently assigned to the St. Paul Police Department's gang unit, where I supervise officers and investigate Asian gang crime in St. Paul, and also assisting other agencies. Just to give you a few little stats here, in St. Paul, we're averaging between 200 and 300 Hmong girl female runaways a year. That's just in the city of St. Paul. Minneapolis has a significant number of runaways. They're trying to collect data. I've also heard from Champlain Park, Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park. All the communities in the metro area have a problem with young runaway girls, primarily Hmong girls. Unfortunately, when some of these girls run away, they're raped, they're put into prostitution. It is very underground. It is difficult to get involved with the investigations because the girls do not come forward oftentimes. Some stats for you from Midwest Children's Resource Center at Children's Hospital down in St. Paul here. They have a program set up to interview young girls that have been sexually assaulted. And between 1998 and 2003, the last time we had results, for gang rape, multiple perpetrators, or prostitution, 75% of the girls that they're seeing are Hmong, 14% or other. 5 or more perpetrators, 66% Hmong, 10% other. Drugs given during victimization, 31% to 6%. And this is one of the big ones. Had run away at least once, 90% to 10%. We see that this is a huge problem. We've created in Ramsey County a Hmong Youth Task Force, where St. Paul Public Schools are educated in trying to identify potential runaways and habitual runaway girls so we can locate them, try to help them. One thing what we'd like to do with this bill is it would not be just for St. Paul Police Department. We want to work with other agencies in the metropolitan area. Right now we have some of the experts, along with a couple members of the Minnesota Gang Strike Force, who are experts with Hmong gangs and this problem. So we would use this money to educate police agencies throughout the metropolitan area and anyone else that wants the training and the help. We also have agencies that would need help locating these girls. use some of the funding to help pay for their officers to locate these girls and to investigate these crimes.
We have a question if you're through with your testimony.
Yes, sir.
Representative Isla.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if the testifiers know the answer to this or not, but what is prompting the disproportionate runaway numbers for young Hmong girls?
Sir, Mr. Chair, there is no real answer. We have girls that are running away from homes where the families are very well off, living in a suburb, parents have excellent jobs. We have girls that are running away from their parents that live in the housing projects. There is no real answer for that. It's just happening. You can go back and ask members of the community. I've worked with the community. I've worked with Representative Tao and other members of the Hmong community. We don't have the answer. We're trying to find out. We interview the girls. Sometimes it's because they feel like they're forced to do more than their brothers, and they might be forced to take on a leadership role in the household, and so that prompts them to run away. Sometimes their friends go out and they run away, and unfortunately sometimes these girls just go out for an evening with some friends who they think are friends, and they end up in these situations. Someone gives them some alcohol or some drugs. We're investigating a case right now between St. Paul, the Metro Gang Strike Force, and Cottage Grove Police Department, where a young Hmong girl went with some friends to a party. She doesn't know where it was. We think it may be in Shoreview, but it started in Cottage Grove. She was given some alcohol, and sometime during the night she was gang raped. We have people involved with this in Wisconsin, Wausau, Wisconsin, St. Paul, Cottage Grove, Minneapolis, multitude of different areas. So for this young girl, it wasn't even running away. It just happened. But the perpetrators in this aren't just in St. Paul. They're all over the metro area. They're in other states. And so it's very difficult for one agency to investigate these crimes. You need help from other agencies. So I don't know if that answers your question. There is no, we don't know why they're running away.
Follow-up, Representative Eastland.
Mr. Chair, I guess the reason I asked the question is because it seems that the activity that the bill kind of addresses is more the investigation. It's more dealing with the problem after it's become the problem. And my question is: are we looking at ways to intervene in the Hmong communities before this stuff becomes an issue, so that is there something that we can do? Have we looked at what we could do to help Hmong families who, for some reason, maybe have, I don't know if there's a cultural thing or something is occurring that is driving this, that we could identify that and help educate people about that issue and help families understand how they can deal with it before it becomes a victim?
There are many different groups.
Now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should have known by now, right? Mr. Chair, members, there are other groups out there within the Hmong community that are working on trying to solve the problem before it becomes a problem. And, for the last several years, a lot of the money have been cut to them as well. So it makes it very difficult to continue to solve the problem. At the same time, Officer Strucka said it pretty well. Some of these families are, have really hard times. Maybe the parents are drug addicts themselves, gambling addicts themselves, and no one's supervising the kids. They end up getting these situations. There are families who have parents who are working two jobs each, and there's no one there to supervise. So you have this formula for disaster, really. And then I think the unique piece about this is because these guys know and understand the culture, they use that to suppress these young ladies from reporting to the parents or a school counselor or an officer, so that makes it very hard for the police to go in there and identify and try to solve the crime. So,
Representative Haas is next.
Thank you very much. Help me understand the structure a little bit here. The Special Investigation Unit Asian Gang Task Force is funded by the St. Paul Police Department, or is it funded by the state through the Minnesota Gang Strike Force, or is it both?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Straka.
Our Special Investigation Unit is part of the St. Paul Police Department. My understanding is they would pretty much be the fiscal responsibility here in order to direct the money to people investigating these crimes and other agencies involved. And, sir, if you wouldn't mind, I could answer that last question about what are we doing for prevention and for these girls running away, if that's all right.
Go ahead.
The last question. I mentioned before, we have the in Ramsey County, we have the Hmong Youth Task Force, and all St. Paul Public Schools have been trained, all the teachers. There's been a videotape that was sent out last year in order to educate teachers on looking for warning signs for runaways and reporting them in St. Paul. And this organization is also starting to work with Hennepin County and Minneapolis Public Schools in order to address that problem too. So we're trying to get this problem out from St. Paul and out metro-wide for getting on top of the problem.
Representative Paz.
Thank you. Continue to help me understand then. What is then the financial relationship between the Minnesota Gang Strike Force and the St. Paul Investigation Unit Asian Strike Force? What would make me feel comfortable that these are not just two very good entities working on the same task and would be better off more united?
Officer Straka.
Mr. Chair, Committee, I believe we do work with the Metro Gang Strike Force. Right now there's, I believe, two investigators that work Southeast Asian crime over there. I mean, obviously we would be working with them. Part of the thing would be for overtime to investigate these crimes. I believe my understanding is St. Paul would not, this money would not all be St. Paul's. We would want to use this money to assist other agencies. Whereas, I mean, we are working with the Metro Gang Strike Force, but our department is, I don't get any money from the Metro Gang Strike Force. That is separate and as far as I know.
One last follow-up.
Representative Paz.
Then, purely in question form, too. I don't have an opinion. I'm asking you for information in order to have an opinion. Thank you. Why wouldn't it be better to put the grant money or extra money in the Minnesota Gang Strike Force and have it allocated throughout the state as needed than rather in the St. Paul and have them allocated to areas that are not under their jurisdiction?
Representative Tao.
That's a question, too.
Sure. Representative Haas, I believe the expertise for this particular crime resides at that St. Paul Police Department, so I prefer that the money goes to the expert and then it could get dispersed throughout the state.
Thank you.
Point,
Representative Coles.
I'm not going to ask a question, just a very brief comment to that point. I'm pleased that Representative Tao brought this bill forward. I'm also happy we're laying it over and we're gonna hold on to it. I guess my only comment is I think we need to be thoughtful about these types of grants. You know, if we decide to fund this program, are we going to be funding a specific program for Minneapolis to combat marijuana? As Mayor Ryback talked about, you know, one in Rochester for Somali gangs, one in Brainerd for the meth problem. You know, I want to be sure that the committee is thoughtful and mindful of that issue. I think Representative Hodge raises a very good point. I think Representative Howe's bill is great, and he's probably right. St. Paul probably is the right place for focusing on Southeast Asian gangs, but I think we just need to be thoughtful of that. As we're, I don't want to have a whole parade of local communities coming in trying to do statewide issues if we have a infrastructure already in place that might be better suited to address that.
Thank you, Representative Qualls. And Representative Tao, this is sort of a bill that has room to change. I would suggest that you'd be open to that. I think this is a good bill. We are going to have a day on the gang strike force, so maybe, Representative Tao, if you could come to that meeting, possibly that would be helpful to us to make sure that we're coordinating things and not duplicating services. But I think there are some unique issues in St. Paul that you might not see in other areas, maybe in Minneapolis. Representative Mulder, you're next.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I agree with we see a lot of things in Minneapolis, just about everything. And I guess following on both Representative Qualls and Hawes, I'm interested in this. I remember, is it Straka?
Yes, sir.
I remember from my first year here 10 years ago, I remember working with you on some of the, and I think it's, for anybody on the committee, I think he was probably the leader on Southeast Asian gang problems, and so I recognize his expertise. I'm also concerned because though now Hennepin County has far more Southeast Asians than Ramsey County, so we have the problems, and I haven't heard the word of any other, for instance, Lao gangs have become a problem over there. Nobody's mentioned anything except Hmong gangs, and how much does this branch out to other Southeast Asian gangs? And I guess I was looking at it and said, supplement salaries for undercover officers, purchase narcotics through drug stings, pay informants. Those three things, are those actually going on all over the metro area and maybe even our state, or are those funds all directed to actions? In other words, your police, if they're going to your police, they basically have jurisdiction in St. Paul. You're probably not going out to Brooklyn Park unless there's something different on that. And so I'd like to know just exactly what that goes for. I mean, the fourth one, educating other officers in Minnesota, obviously is everywhere. If this, and I guess I'm a little concerned, as the other two representatives said, about where this is going, and I recognize that the gang, Southeast gang problem started in St. Paul, but they've spread all over. I think this isn't enough if we're going to spread it statewide, but I would like to see it statewide. And then just one other question after you're done with that. The new youth crime lieutenant for Minneapolis told me that one of the problems they're having, you talked about all the runaways and the trouble and crime they're getting into. He said one of the problems was adults that are unrelated taking, and these kids are inducing them in. Is that a problem in this area? So that maybe you want to
several
quickly
questions.
Do that one.
Can you quickly respond? We have Representative Blesch, Smith, Hillstrom, and then I'd like to, if we could, maybe we'll have to have Representative Tao come back when we talk about the gang strike force, because we have four groups of people who have come a distance to testify before today.
You can just
can you hold off? Do you need the answer now?
If he's coming back.
Okay. Is there some, Representative Lesch, is there something that...
I just want to ask you to be pretty brief, Mr. Chair. Sergeant Strzok, I wanted to know two things. One, if you could reiterate a list of, say, the older or more established Asian gangs that you've been working with, and if there are new ones developing, I'd like to hear the names of those. Secondly, it strikes me that you're saying that Asian gangs are a tougher nut to crack than are maybe some of the other gangs, and if you could say briefly why that is, and I'm not looking for an answer of, well, it's a cultural difference, but a couple of specifics on how it is different.
Officer Straka.
Mr. Chair, committee, some of our more established gangs are the MOD, Menace of Destruction, originally from California. Those individuals who shot Deputy Taysen 2 years ago, both those guys were from California. The Purple Brothers are still very active. The Asian Crips are still very active in recruiting. You're talking about new members. We just I just did some search words in the last week with TLT, True Local Thugs, a bunch of new kids who just showed up starting a gang. There's 20 to 30 of them. Been involved in several shootings lately. Within the last year, they've appeared. So they're shooting each other and shooting other gangs over the word respect and disrespect, because other gangs are saying stuff about them, calling them names, so they're shooting up their houses and cars and assaulting them. That's one of our new gangs. Well, your other question was?
The other question, Mr. Chair, Sergeant Straka, was these Asian gangs you appear to say are tougher to get into. Why is that?
Mr. Chair, committee, with the Southeast Asian gangs, it's extremely difficult to get information. Most of our information is we have to either arrest somebody and they want to cooperate on that charge or something else, or we're paying informants for information. None of our Hmong officers in St. Paul or Minneapolis can go undercover in the community. The community is tight-knit, close-knit, and we could not get an officer undercover because somebody would know who they are. It's not going to happen. We have a lot of Hmong officers in the metro Apollo area, but the question about Lao officers, Vietnamese officers, there are very few. So most of our information does come from either paying informants, getting information from community members, or when we arrest somebody, that we let them off, maybe go on a charge because they give us information, they lead us to a bigger arrest. I'm not saying that it's more difficult than some of the other groups, but we cannot ever put anybody undercover in the Southeast Asian community. I know that officers have gone undercover in some of the other groups, but in Minnesota, I know for a fact that we have never put anybody undercover in the Hmong community.
Representative Smith. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just have one question, and it'll be for Lieutenant Straka. And by the way, Mr. Chairman, I will be brief. It's one question. And I'm a firm believer that all questions can be answered in one of three ways, either with a yes, a no, or an I don't know. So, Lieutenant Straka, I've got a question for you, but first, I'm aware of a year 2000 report that the U.S. State Department reported to Congress that more than a million women and girls are being smuggled across international borders each year and forced into prostitution. I'm also aware that according to a U.N. report, 20% approximately of those females are brought into the United States and forced into prostitution. So we're talking also about basically human trafficking, and I believe that's in excess of a $9 billion a year profit that criminals are making. A year or two ago, when you were before our committee, you had compelling testimony, in my opinion. Just a moment ago, however, you used the words some of these girls fall into these situations. I'll have a question in just a half minute.
This is a good question.
The question is longer than your answer, I hope. Your testimony, when you were before the committee before, you said that hundreds of Hmong girls are being used as party favors for meth customers of Hmong gangs who keep the girls in warehouse townhouses in the area and use them as such. Here's the question. Will this money, do you intend with this money, and will you use it to bust up some of these gangs and save some of these women? Mr. Straka.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for the promotion up to lieutenant. I'm only a sergeant, so field promotion. Yes, that is our goal.
Okay, what I'd like to do, Representative Hillstrom, you get a quick question, and maybe we could get the... I think this is a big issue, and we're going to need to have more discussion, and we'll do it on the day that we have the gang strike force here. So, Representative Hillstrom, if you... And then Haas and Bigham also had questions. If you could hold off till we have that day, would that be okay?
I just have a comment. I don't need an answer.
Let Representative Hillstrom.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tao, this really is a big issue and becoming more of an issue in the suburbs, and so whatever information you could provide to us about how this might work out, I do represent Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, and we are seeing an influx of this. But the other question is, we also happen to be number one now in teen pregnancy, and I believe that a large amount of that is because of the new immigrants with these teens in this kind of situation and prostitution. So are you doing something to investigate in that way as well when these young girls, 13, 14 years old, are showing up in, you know, hospitals having babies? That might be another way to crack down on how this is happening or getting information.
Mr. Chair,
Baca.
Committee, if usually, in, at least in Ramsey County with Midwest Children's Resource Center, if a young girl that age, 12 or 13, shows up pregnant, there should be a police investigation into that to determine hopefully who the father is. And if the father is older, within the law, 2 or 3 years older than that young girl, obviously there would be a police investigation. Oftentimes these girls won't cooperate, and if there's no cooperation, there isn't we can do. But if they do say that it's this older person, the police department in that jurisdiction should be doing an investigation into who the father is and if criminal charges can be filed.
Representative Bigham, did you have like a comment or a question where we can get... Okay, very good.
Mr. Chair, Sergeant, follow-up to Representative Wilson's question. Do you work with the BCA to compile information so that if Cottage Grove would need information, or if Chaska would need information, is that able to be provided through the BCA at a...
Officer Strzok.
Mr. Chair, as far as I know, I don't know if the BCA has anyone working on this problem. I work with this problem with people from the Metro Gang Strike Force and any police agency that calls for our help. So I don't think the BCA really has a clearinghouse for that. I get calls from St. Paul from police agencies throughout the metropolitan area and other states regarding this problem. So that's how it becomes aware to me.
Representative Haas, you have the last brief word.
I won't need a response. Okay. The response can come when they come back. We have testimony that it is difficult or impossible to place undercover agents. And then we have a request for supplementary salaries for undercover officers, page 1, line 1.1. So if they clear that up when they come back.
Okay. Representative Tao, Officer Straka, thank you for presenting the bill. We will have you back. I think we need to have more discussion, not only about your bill, but the whole issue the Asian gangs in the metropolitan area and what we're doing about it. So if you'd be willing to come back at a later date, I'd appreciate that. Representative Tao.
Can I just, Mr. Chair, one quick answer to your question. Many of the users of these girls are white, older white men. So.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Representative Tao, Officer Strzok. Okay, we're going to hear now from some of the crime victim groups and apologize for that the bill took so long. If we, hopefully we can get through all of the groups today, but as you can see, that was a controversial bill that I didn't think would take quite so long. We're going to hear from the general crime victims, Jennifer Nodes, Deb Fulton, if you'd like to come up, please. And I think I think Ms. Lacombe has communicated that we'd like you to take 10 minutes and leave a little bit of time for questions from committee members. Could you introduce yourself for the record, and for people who are going to testify, you have to speak through the chair because we're recording this.
My name is Jennifer Notis. I represent the Minnesota General Crime Victim Coalition. This is Deb Holton from the Minnesota Chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
applicants that you have raised today all with these people.
A lot of them.
Ms. Millage, is it possible you can start your presentation without your PowerPoint? Or
Mr. Chair, I can. Thank you. Everyone should have a copy of it. Just to give a general overview of the issues related to general crime, I did provide what the mission of the Minnesota General Crime Victim Coalition is. We are a statewide organization. If you are not familiar, the Office of Justice Program identifies four specific areas of crime. That's general crime, sexual assault, domestic violence, and abused children. Obviously, we cover the general crime area. As you'll find on your PowerPoint presentation, there is a question that lists, what is general crime? It's used to define areas of crime that aren't covered under those other three areas of sexual assault, domestic violence, or abused children. It doesn't preclude advocates of general crime, however, from servicing victims who suffer from those crimes as well. The next three slides show the different areas that general crime covers. It is those crimes which the coalition has identified that an advocate might cover. For those of you who don't want to do the math, you'll find that there's 39 identifiable crimes under the title of general crime. Just like the other areas of crime, victims suffer from pain, anger, hopelessness, confusion, fear, and frustration related to that crime. Due to the vast number of crimes covered under the general crime title, advocates really must be uniquely trained and prepared. At the present time, there are 65 programs within the state of Minnesota that are funded through the Office of Justice Program to provide general crime services within the state of Minnesota. These funded programs are both community-based and systems-based. 29 are county attorney-based programs. 26 are community-based programs. Some of these community-based programs are statewide organizations. An example of that would be Mothers Against Drunk Driving or Parents of Murdered Children. Thank you. Just catch us up here. Five are county-based programs without specific assignments, either a county attorney or a social services institution, and three are law enforcement and community corrections-based programs. Of these 65 programs, they cover 60 Minnesota counties, leaving 27 unfunded and unserved counties in the way of general crime services. Each program that's funded through the Office of Justice Programs is required to meet programmatic standards. And on the back of your handout, you will find a long list of what these standards are. These are the minimum level of services that they must provide to both primary and secondary victims. Primary victim is a person whom the offense was committed, who has suffered personal harm as a direct result of the offense, or a witness to the act, or the actual or threatened violence. A secondary victim is any person who's been affected by another's direct experience with violent crime, abuse, or trauma. They're often referred to as affected others and include neighbors, families, friends, etc. Program services, according to the Office of Justice Programs, are to be relevant to the populations that exist within their community. But the reality is that no program is the same. Even if you look across the board at all the county attorney-based programs, none of them are the same, but the standards of service are. Standards of service start with crisis intervention. You'll find the definition that the Office of Justice Program uses to identify what the needs are in the ways of crisis intervention. What I've provided on the next slide, however, are greater examples of what crisis intervention services mean to the actual advocates. A list of the services that they daily provide to the victims of general crime. Again, the next is emergency services as it's defined by the Office of Justice Program. But what it means to service for advocates is a little bit more expansive. With support services as well, you're going to find the great examples to be extremely long. Court-related services, especially with those in the county attorney's office, is going to be quite expansive. legal resources, again, it's going to be expanded on the next slide. In addition to the services listed above, general crime programs also must meet additional programmatic services, not necessarily dealing with contact with the victim. That includes staff development requirements, community education and outreach requirements, systems change and professional training requirements, and partnering with other organizations. Additionally, for county attorney and law enforcement-based programs, there are additional notification requirements that must be met to meet the victim rights legislation that's dictated in Statute 611A. Now, I realize I'm going through these documents fast, and I do that because I realize we are very short on time today. Please, if you have questions, I look forward to answering them and take the time to look through. An advocate's work is not a simple job of contacting the victim, explaining the criminal justice process, and walking them through it. It is the beginning of the case, which includes discussing with them investigation. If it's going to be prosecuted, then walking them through the criminal justice service, and then also the aftercare. That could be short-term counseling. It could be long-term counseling. It could start with assisting a victim who needs to go to the morgue to identify a family member who's been killed. It could be assisting an individual who needs to go to the hospital who's going to have a rape examination. The duties of a victim advocate in the way of general crime are so expansive, it's difficult to give you a PowerPoint presentation that covers all of them. With 39 identifiable areas of crime, to train a victim advocate in that area is difficult, and it's an ongoing process that needs to be continuing, because anybody could come through. Especially in some of our smaller areas, they serve one county that may be small, but they are the only victim advocate. So they are responsible for being knowledgeable on 39 different areas of crime. They may see one homicide every year. They may see one homicide every 10 years. But they need to be able to service that victim as they walk through the door and not just make up the services as they go. How does it all add up? In fiscal year 2006, 37,000 primary and secondary victims were served by general crime victim programs. And behind each of these numbers is an individual's trauma, a story of personal suffering, and the needs, as I discussed, are beyond classification. So too must the skills and ability of the general crime advocate and the program. The end of my presentation.
Ms. Fulton, did you have some remarks?
I think Ms. Fulton came with us today, Mr. Chair, in order to answer any questions that the committee might have about the services of a general crime advocate.
And Mr. Chair and committee, I just wanted to add that I am the state victim advocate for Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Thank you. Members have questions. Representative Liebley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our testifiers. Thank you for your presentation. This is really impressive, and certainly this is very, very important work. My question is there a way that the services get evaluated? I mean, I recognize that every crime victim is in a different situation, but is there any way that we can look overall at the program to see, how well the money is used, to see if it's going to the right places? I mean, do you do any kind of evaluation piece?
Mr. Chair, committee, the Office of Justice Programs does require the programs that are funded through their agency to keep track of numbers and do mid-year and end-of-year reporting, but they are truly the agency that's responsible for the dispersion of funds that are allocated through the legislator and would be responsible for any sort of review of services.
Representative Liebling. Representative Eastland, and then Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, the testifier. One of the slides that you showed indicated that services through OJP are available in 60 Minnesota counties, leaving 27 counties without any service. How are victims in those 27 counties served, and can you give us an idea of where those 27 counties are?
Ms. Notes.
Mr. Chair, committee, I apologize, I did have information on what those 27 counties were, and I did not include it in the slide. That's something I could provide at a later date. I don't have them off the top of my head. That's a very good question, though, however, in how victims in those counties are receiving services. In some of the counties in the outlying areas, What we find is that they go to other counties to receive the services if desperately needed, or they just choose not to receive those services, which obviously is a tragedy within itself. What we find for those individuals who are required to, as I discussed, there's some notification requirements under 611A. What we find is that the individuals within the county attorney who have no training in the area of victim services are providing the letters, but unfortunately, because they're limited in their training, it's difficult for them to service beyond that point.
Representative Rush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Notice, and I'm sorry if I missed it in your presentation, but do you find, or have you found in your numbers, that there is any one crime or subset of crimes that demand most of the services of general crime victims? And if it is, for example, crimes against persons, is there a subset of that? The second part is, have you been successful in working with the courts on restitution matters to supplement the work that you're doing?
Ms. Nellis.
Mr. Chair, committee, to address your first question of whether there's a specific area within general crime that takes up the majority of an advocate's services, we haven't identified at this point anyone that's specific. It's difficult because you could take a victim of a homicide who may need, you would think, expansive services, but in their situation may need limited services. They may have a good, strong base in their family and friends and support system. They don't need the assistance of an advocate in the long term. But you could take the victim of a burglary for something that others may view as less serious, and their service may be expansive. So it's difficult to really put a number or count on which ones seeking more are additional services are the majority of time for an advocate. As to your second question about restitution, that question probably would be more appropriately addressed to an advocate who works within the programs who has to deal directly with restitution. In my understanding and my history as working as an advocate, restitution has been a continual problem for victims. It is a frustrating process that they don't understand, and they often have difficulty recovering the funds that they lost through the victimization of the crime.
Mr. Chairman, committee, if I can also address that question.
Awesome.
I have found that the Minnesota State Reparations Board is more resourceful to the victims because they receive that money immediately, and then they don't have to worry about the restitution process and whether they're going to be paid for those expenses.
I might add to that that the governor has recommended $500,000 for the biennium for crime victims reparations program. But we will have further discussion on. Representative Dominguez, maybe we'll move on after this because we're.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your slide, your community education and outreach, could you speak a little bit about that? What are you finding and who are you outreaching to as far as minority groups?
Ms. Notes.
Mr. Chair, committee, I appreciate the fact that you highlighted the community education outreach element of the service requirement. What we're finding is that with the limited funds that programs are using, they often have difficulty achieving the community education and outreach goal as much as they would like to. When a victim walks through your door, that's your primary concern, and so they're doing and addressing victims on a one-on-one basis. Community outreach is a secondary aspect of that. But we have found that programs are successful in going into the schools and doing some training in that regard, and then training law enforcement as well. As far as getting into community and doing community outreach to citizens as it is, that would be something that is in my understanding, grossly underdone. It's something that they just haven't had the opportunity, the time, the staff, the resources to complete.
And then we'll stop.
This is a follow-up to what you just said. You made a comment about limited funding. Exactly how has the funding been in the last few years? Has it been increasing or is it pretty stable?
Ms. Notes.
Mr. Chair, committee, the funding requirement, well, the funding discussion, honestly, probably could take hours to cover. There has been a decrease consistently over the last several years, which have hit our programs hard, and they've seen and suffered a loss of services and what we define as an erosion of services to crime victims within the state of Minnesota.
Just a follow-up comment.
Representative Olin.
I'm coming from one of the county attorney's offices that did do it because I used to be a county attorney. And I am aware of that answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nodes, Ms. Fulton, for testifying before the committee.
Thank you.
And next, we'll hear from the Battered Women's Programs. Again, if you could keep your...
Ms. Weber coming up.
Representative Cornish, do you have a comment before we...
Oh, Mr. Chair, if it's possible, if we could have one of our fiscal analysts or researcher put together a list. It's kind of overwhelming how many advocacy groups and coalitions. If we could just get them all on one page, if you're a victim of crime or assault or anything, how many advocacy groups are there out there and maybe where their funding comes from? Just a short paper, just so we know, all in one or two pages. I'm just thinking about duplication, and I mean, wonder... No hurry, I mean, but before it comes up again. But
no hurry, just
by paper. Towards the end of the meeting would be nice.
No, in like a week or
is that something that OJP can put together, Mr. Carter? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I think, yes, OJP could maybe do that. They probably have a list already on that issue, so we can send that on to Mr. Chair.
Mr. O'Leary, can you do that? Thank you. We'll get that for you, Representative Cornish. For the committee, I think everyone would like to see it. Okay. We've got PowerPoint 2.
Yeah.
That was sort of a bad invention, wasn't it? Takes all the spontaneity out of a presentation, too.
We can be
okay. Can I just make an announcement before they begin? That buzzing noise has to do with somebody up here has their cell phone on. Or a BlackBerry.
I don't have any.
Technology has... maybe we can start until we get this set up. I'm not sure how you're planning on presenting, but yeah. Please introduce yourselves and for the record, and please go through the chair. And
okay, sorry. For the record, my name is Carla Frucci, and I'm the Director of Public Policy and Systems Change at the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And I'm here actually just to be more of a facilitator for main presenters and to stand for questions, so I'll be brief. I just wanted to say that the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women started in 1978 to serve as a unifying voice for battered women and to link battered women's programs in the state with a common purpose of ending domestic violence. We are a statewide membership-based organization. We have over 90 programs, and I think at last count, we had about 94. These programs, our membership includes shelters and safe homes, community advocacy programs, criminal justice intervention projects, state and national training and technical assistance organizations, human rights organizations, and homeless shelters. Our goal at MCDW is to promote individual, institutional, and cultural social change. We work to end oppression based on gender, race, age, sexual orientation, class, and disability. The work that we do every day includes, in order to achieve those goals, public policy advocacy, information and resources, public awareness, training and technical assistance, and networking. The activities that we do to achieve those goals are we provide resources and referral, we do legislative and public policy advocacy, we sponsor training events for programs that serve battered women, and we coordinate statewide task force meetings. And unfortunately, I think I'm going to move on quickly. You have all of this in your handouts because I really want Dory to walk you through her piece. So I'm just going to end here and stand for questions at the end of our testimony.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dorian Eater. I'm the Systems Advocacy Coordinator for the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Can people hear me if I'm sitting here?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So.
All right. We provided you with a basic statistical overview handout in your packet that should answer some of the general questions about how many women and children received services from our programs in 2006 and what kind of services. I'm going to spend my few minutes here trying to provide some insight into what battered women are facing when they make the decision to leave an abuser and how our programs practically help move victims from point A to point B. initially, 30 years ago when we started this work, we started with shelter, which provided some immediate safety. And we really thought that if we could provide the opportunity for women to flee domestic violence safely, that would allow them to move on with their lives and live violence-free lives. What we discovered is that's just the beginning of a process. Leaving is the beginning, not the ending, of how battered women escape abusive relationships. And so our services evolved over time to meet those needs as they arose and the barriers that battered women faced as they were trying to escape abuse. Advocates do provide safe shelter and emotional support, which I think are the things people immediately think about when they think about what domestic violence advocates do. But beyond that, the primary responsibility of an advocate is really to navigate through the system and around the barriers that battered women face, the practical realities of that. So, unfortunately, this is much more impressive and powerful.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're going to get it. In your packet, you have a family. And this is Rachel and her children, who are Christopher, who's 6, and Alicia, who's 2. Rachel's been with her husband for 8 years, her husband Tom. She's had enough. And after the last assault, she's called 911. So if you flip to the next slide, you'll see what happens. All the different processes that happen to her as a result of that 911 call. Right? The advocate's job is to make sure that she knows what's going on with the system, to interact with the system, to make sure that the criminal justice system is functioning well. If her children were present, there might be a report to child protection. And these are all of the systems and processes that she's going to encounter in the child protection system. An advocate needs to be there to help inform that system about what she's facing. In the next slide, she might have gotten a report of the police incident to her housing authority, and now she's subject to eviction. So someone needs to be working with the housing authorities to make sure that her rights are protected and that she doesn't lose that housing. If she decides to file for a restraining order, this is the order for protection process. Advocates are critical here to help women file the documents, go to court, stand up to their abuser in the courtroom, and get all the relief that they're entitled to under the law. If a custody battle follows, here's just some of the procedures she might be encountering. And here's the whole map together. So here's what can happen to this woman and her children just as a result of that 911 call. And this doesn't include, it doesn't even account for her needing to hold down a job, to get her daughter Alicia to and from childcare, to deal with the practical realities also of facing a violent abuser who's out there creating fear and conflict in the world. So I just want people to consider, if you were facing this in your own life, how complicated this would be. So the advocate's job, yes, is to make sure that the victim's emotional needs are being met, but this is a real practical set of problems that require intensive advocacy and a level of engagement with every level of the system. So that's what advocates do. They don't just work with Rachel. They work with those systems to make sure they're responsive to Rachel and doing everything they should be doing to protect her and her kids. That's what we ask them to do. That's what we expect the system to do. So advocacy programs will always provide the basic emergency safe shelter, the emotional support, the crisis intervention that Jennifer spoke about earlier. We don't turn people away when they come to us in that kind of crisis. But the resources that it takes to actually manage the system, to engage the system, to change it for the better, because it's not just about Rachel, it's about the other women who are going to come behind Rachel, that's what takes the resources. And so when we use resources, that's the impact that it has. We don't have the capacity to engage that system as strongly as we should. Even when we're able to provide all the resources, and Rachel does everything we've asked her to do, because this is what we ask battered women to do in order to leave and be safe, we can't protect everybody. And we can't protect women's lives and children's lives from determined abusers. We still haven't figured out how to guarantee safety. We can't do it. Also attached with your materials is our most recent femicide report. There are 20 women who lost their lives to domestic violence, 17 of them murdered by current or former intimate partners. And, well, that is devastating to those women's families and communities. The fact that only 20 women lost their lives is a miracle. There were nearly 60,000 people who accessed services this year. Many of them, and I speak as an advocate with 11 years of experience, many of them barely survived. They were lucky to escape from their lives. And I'm talking about women who were shot and survived, were stabbed and survived, who were strangled to the point of unconsciousness and survived. And their survival was more a matter of luck. So the fact that only 20 women lost their lives is remarkable, so devastating for those communities. And I just want the committee and the chair to consider, when you think about that number, 60,000 people, those are individuals whose lives have been altered forever. And when you think about this, 20 women especially, as you hear from the next speaker, think about the wave of devastation, not just the loss of one life, but the wave of devastation that spreads out from a domestic violence homicide, which is the ultimate form of violence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eder. Next person to testify.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Vicki Seliger-Swenson, and thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of you today. I'm going to talk about my sister, Terry Lee. My sister, Terry, was the 15th woman murdered in the state of Minnesota. Also killed that fatal morning was Tim Hawkinson, Sr., a man who she planned to marry, whom we loved and adored. But to many, my sister was more than number 15. To my parents, she was every daughter's dream. She was kind and caring. She was an honor roll student. She was a three-sport athlete. She served on student council and sang in concert choir. As an adult woman, she still made contact with my parents every single day. As a sister, there was no one better. She was my best friend. We did everything together. We played on multiple sports teams. She was the maid of honor in my wedding, and I was the maid of honor in hers. She married a man whom she had known since seventh grade. His name is Ty Lee, and they had four beautiful children together. He died in a car accident in 2001. And with the rally of her friends and her family, she picked up those four kids, ages 1, 3, 5, and 7, and moved on. She began dating this man, a trusted colleague at 3M, where she worked, who seemed safe. They had mutual friends. He had been a 25-year employee with no prior record. They dated on and off for 2 years before she ended the relationship for good. She had the police involved on a couple of times this spring before, on July 29th, he broke into her home and attacked her with two butcher knives. She escaped when her neighbor saw his car and called 911. I am proud of my sister because she followed the system that we have created to protect women and children. She gave statements to the police. She went to court. She testified. She begged the judge not to let him out. And these words are documented in the court papers. I have no doubt in my mind he will return to my home to kill me. 2 days later, he was let out on bail after paying the 10% required bond of $7,500. One of the conditions of his release was that he would have no contact with my sister, her family, or her children. Yet he violated that contact order multiple times. Once his father sent an email to Terry at 3M where she worked, asking her to meet with his son. She called police. There was no arrest. He lived in River Falls, Wisconsin, and the message she received was they couldn't cross the state line, which we know is not true. He showed up at her daughter's volleyball match on September 20th. She called police. Again, there was no arrest. My sister went above and beyond the system. With the help of Tim, she installed a $4,000 security system for her 5,000-square-foot home. It was armed, it was guarded, it was protected. But unfortunately, it provided a very false sense of security, as it did not work. She kept notes, she made copies of the court order, passed them out to the children's teachers, and informed her friends and family on a daily basis as to where she was and what was going on. Our biggest fear became a reality on September 22, 2006, when her ex-boyfriend broke into her home and killed Terry and Tim, while Terry's two daughters ran to the neighbor's house for help. Her two boys hid in their closet for 2 hours before the SWAT team rescued them. Her ex-boyfriend suffered a self-inflicted gunshot wound and three gunshot wounds from the SWAT team, and he recovered at Regent's Hospital. You see, there are many warning signs that I believe need to be taken seriously. He now awaits trial for two counts of murder in the first degree. The first warning sign was she ended the relationship and left. He was relentless about being with her. He would show up uninvited to her house and to her kids' activities, and each time she called the police. The second warning sign was that he broke into her home, attacked her with butcher knives, and made it clear he wanted her dead as well as himself, because that was the only way that they could forever be together. She made those statements in court and to the police. The third warning sign was that he obviously had access to firearms, as he shot Tim three times and Terry six times before shooting himself. The fourth warning sign was his history of violence last spring and his relentless attempts to maintain the relationship. To me, this was a huge, huge sign that he was a threat to my sister, to her children, and to Tim, and also to society. My sister left behind four orphaned children. And in our country, you don't use that word orphan very often. Taylor is 12, Tyler is 10, Trevor is 8, and Taylor is 6. Tim also had three boys whom he loved and adored and spoke very highly of. Tim Jr., who's 24, and twins Tom and Andrew, who are 22. Seven kids lost their parents that morning. As for who we are now, we are changed forever. My parents are devastated. My husband and I have three children of our own and are now raising my sister's four kids. We have a fourth grade daughter who is 9, and we have 21-year-olds. The impact on my family, besides the obvious grief and devastation, is huge. And I still feel like, even though my sister is gone, she still is being mistreated by the system. Taxpayers spent $1,000 a day to guard this man at Regent's Hospital in overtime so that he would not hurt himself or hurt other people. It's very reactive spending. My husband and I were in Hennepin County Court 2 weeks ago, and I learned that we have to bond every dollar in my sister's estate because she had no will. By the time Tara, who is 6, is of age, that could be anywhere from $25,000 to $35,000 in premiums that those children will never have. They will never get that money back. The financial impact is huge, and I think the emotional impact is quite obvious. I guess what I'm asking you today is to closely examine the system that we've created to protect women and children. My sister, my family, we are proof that it could happen to anyone. The stereotypes that we have of battered women and even batterers are refuted by this story. My sister did not live in a rural area. This man was a chemist, a professional man, and those stereotypes are refuted by this. It could happen to anyone. It could be your sister. It could be your daughter. And I guess I'm asking you to closely look at how we fund services for women and to look at the system that we've created. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Swenson. And I think I speak for the committee that our hearts and prayers go out to you and your family. Whether you want to respond to this or the panel about, I think most of us read about this case, but if you can say more about how the system failed. We can enact all the laws we want here, but this clearly seems like that there was a failure in law enforcement as well as the court to understand how dangerous this individual was. And I don't know if you want to speak to the no contact orders or the bail, or and we don't have a whole lot of time, but maybe you could shed some light on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This isn't a yes or a no answer. Sorry. I'll be brief, though. I don't want to be all over the place because I do think there were many systematic failures. To me, the most obvious, well, we have really two, the bail issue of he paid more to get out on bail than I did to pay for my sister's funeral. But the one that really bothers me probably the most is the no contact order, and that was a process put in place by the judge, and my sister had to prove through the court system when the police were called that court order existed, whereas it should be, police officers should have access to that with today's technology. That seems that they should have quick access to that information, and then there has to be better communication between the communities, the community lines as well as the state line. This man lived across the river, and they did arrest him on July 29th, so that says that it is possible, but I think better communication about those no contact orders when they are violated. They need to be arrested.
Let's turn to Corina. She has a question.
Mr. Chair, ma'am, one thing that you folks could do to really help us out is when we have our special hearing for CrimNet, come down and testify, because that's a very items that are addressed in CrimNet is timely, responsive information to the cop in the car on the MDT or whatever communication system they have. I'm on the CrimNet board. We're facing a real tough time getting funding. We're never going to be able to enact enough laws to protect folks like you. And one thing I'm wondering is, I was with another cop, gave instructions on assault and rape prevention, and I was kicked and fumbled and thrown to the floor by women all day long, and they felt good about it because they were able to empower themselves. If the system doesn't work for them, they were able to empower themselves, but I had a trouble getting coalition groups to help with the class, and I'm wondering, do you have any system where you encourage that, where self-empowerment or self-defense or taking action if the system fails you in classes like that? Richie?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, self-defense classes definitely are empowering. Unfortunately, they don't really get at the prevention side of the issue. I think self-empowerment obviously really does help, and I'm going to disclose something. I was actually a crime victim a few weeks ago. I was mugged in our parking lot, and I've had a self-defense class, and I was too scared to even do anything about it. So I would say that when we start talking about prevention, we need to think about the before the crime even happens, before you're in that moment of fear. We need to look at the social norms that we have. We need to look at how we talk about relationships and in schools. So I would invite you to work with me and our organization in looking at some of those primary prevention measures.
I want to give you a couple of minutes to address the governor's recommendation for shelters. Do you want to take those 2 minutes to do that? Or?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. A few years ago, we received a restoration of some budget cuts, but our concern is that our programs have remained flat for the last 10 years and have not received an increase. And we look forward to working with all of you in a funding bill to increase the base funding of services across the state, not just for battered women's shelters and community-based programs, but also rape crisis centers and general crime programs. And the three organizations that you're going to hear from today, we're all working together to come up with a 4% cost of living increase to increase the base funding for programs. We'll have more time, I'm sure, to talk the details of that, because it is a little complicated. Jennifer noticed, talked a little bit about the complexity of it, and we want to come to you with a solid information.
Any other questions? Thank you all, especially Ms. Swenson, for your testimony. We're going to take the sexual assault programs next and go just a little bit over, members. Mr. Frost, I know that where's Mr. Frost? He's still. Is it possible we can have you come back another day, or is that what? Okay, I'm just wondering. I just don't think we're going to get done, and we have another committee, I believe. Is another committee coming in here?
Session.
Session. Yeah, we have forgot about it. Minor omission. Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Donna Dunn. I'm the director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and we are an association of direct service providers, rape crisis centers, and advocacy programs across the state of Minnesota. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about the background and the status of sexual assault advocacy programming in Minnesota, and to also offer an opportunity for one of our partner programs to talk about what it means to be doing advocacy services today. We also feel that we owe a debt of gratitude to Representative Tao and to Sergeant Straka for the information they shared earlier, because that helps you get a broader picture of the issue that we're talking about, which is sexual assault. As they discussed the bill that they are working on and the issues that they are facing, those are the kinds of issues that our partner programs also partner with law enforcement and prosecutors and local communities. So I appreciate that they were able to share that information with you. Well, before anyone can actually address and effectively solve a problem, one needs to be able to understand what the problem is. And what we know is that our communities, our public in general, struggles with understanding what sexual assault is. For that reason, again, I'm thankful that Representative Tao shared the information that he did. We know that there are very public cases that you see in news reporting daily, but that is really the tip of the iceberg, and that is not the typical sexual assault that is happening to Minnesota citizens and that our community-based programs are responding to. What we know about sexual assault is that it is often committed, usually committed, behind closed doors. It's a very private kind of crime. It's typically not the kind of crime that attracts attention from people in the immediate area. These are often occur quite quietly and quite privately. There's not typically intervention from other family members or neighbors because the awareness that an assault is occurring is often not there. Sexual assault usually occurs between two people who know one another. The stranger assault is the rare assault. More typically, there is an acquaintanceship between the two people, and over time, trust has been gained. And I should stop here and say you do have a PowerPoint in front of you or available in your packet that I'm speaking from. It is not here, however. And sexual assault cases and assaults typically leave few physical marks. While there is often injury, these are not the kinds of cases where you can look at an individual and say, yes, I can see the physical trauma of sexual assault. It is not typically visible. These are confidence crimes, where offenders will violate the trust of somebody who is vulnerable and take advantage of that vulnerability. And vulnerable, I would like to say, can be both physically and emotionally vulnerable or mentally vulnerable. It can also simply be trusting, being a trusting individual, being isolated, perhaps being intoxicated through one's own ingestion or otherwise being given intoxicating beverages or drugs. It can also be vulnerability that's connected with surprise. I didn't know that this was going to happen. In any case, typically victims are unable to defend themselves or unable to act to protect themselves, although you raise a very good question about how we might be empowered. What we do know about sexual assault is that it happens to women, it happens to men, it happens to teens, it happens to children. We also know that offenders are regular guys. The previous testimony from Ms. Lenson identified a batterer who was a regular guy, held down a job. Most sex offenders also have that sort of profile. They function well in communities, they attend church, they have graduate degrees, they have a good business record, they are teachers, they are ministers in our midst, and they don't show up as the scary social misfit that we oftentimes think of when we think of sex offenders. We know that alcohol is the number one drug that is used in facilitating sexual assault. We hear a lot of interesting information about date rape drugs and the use of date rape drugs. We will remind you that alcohol is the number one date rape drug. And we also know that victims very, very infrequently report sexual assault for a variety of reasons. They are among the most silent of crime victims.
This issue is vastly underreported. A national study a few years ago identified that probably only 16% of sexual assault victims come forward to law enforcement. If you think about that, that means that 84% of offenders are not identified by the system, are not held accountable, their behavior is not addressed, and they continue to remain in communities. And we also know that that victims themselves are very confused about sexual assault. Our inability to understand the dynamics and to completely decode the dynamics of sexual assault leave victims in a place where they challenge themselves. Should I have done something different? Should I not have done this? Should I not have said that? And they become very involved in looking at their own behavior and not understanding that what has happened to them was not their fault. They are not to blame, but in fact it was a violent crime committed against them. For good reasons, victims still fear not being believed by systems, and that does continue to happen. Being blamed, they fear retaliation by the assailant. Threats that have been lodged could in fact be carried out. And they fear ridicule and shame and even being shunned by their community. And in some cultural communities, that's a very, very real and very promising experience. Victims often question, as I said, their own actions and hold themselves accountable far too often. What we see as the beginning of a solution is that there is a strong and well-supported and effective local sexual assault advocacy program. These programs, and I won't go into more detail, you've heard both from MCBW staff and representatives and the general crime victim staff and representatives, that the broad array of services that advocates provide are incredibly powerful in helping victims and communities understand what is going on. But a strong and effective and active and accessible advocacy program in a community goes a long way to starting to change the status quo. The services in Minnesota regarding sexual assault are these. There is a network of 56 agencies which are funded to serve all but 13 counties in Minnesota and 6 Indian reservations. We work closely with the coalition to serve Native women and Indian country around the issue of sexual assault, and we know that they have identified the need for additional funding and additional support for reservation-based programs. Most of these services are housed within private nonprofits in the state of Minnesota, but we do have some stellar programs that are part of county agencies, community corrections in Dodge, Fillmore, Olmsted counties, for example, or even within law enforcement agencies in the northwestern part of the state, as well as public health here in Ramsey County. But in addition to those, most of our advocacy programs are private nonprofits existing outside of traditional social service or criminal justice systems. On an average, our programs function with a budget, and this is an average of $45,000. We have one program that continuously reminds us that they serve 6,000 square miles with 1.5 FTEs, and that's a part of the picture. But for as critical as these services are, and these services grew out of in the mid-70s out of a growing awareness that we didn't understand all of what was happening around sexual assault. That was the time that statutes were rewritten, that training for professionals was prioritized. Beyond those types of services, I just want to say that the impact really increases when a program is able to do outreach to underserved parts of the community. And this is critical for victims to understand what the issue of sexual assault is and that there are services available. Education, to help create a jury pool that can more adequately respond in that setting if a case should go to court. Training, and then primary prevention. And I would love to talk more about primary prevention because we see that as the direction that we need to start to focusing. I've given you on the handout a summary of the program standards. I won't go through those again. They're very similar to what Ms. Notice talked about. I will just say that we face challenges. aside from our challenge of helping individuals in the public understand what, in fact, sexual assault really is, we face the challenge of making sure that we are able to sustain the services that we've lost due to inflation. Our programs, as you've heard, have not realized increased funding to make up for inflation, and so they've had to adjust the way they do business. And we know that in that adjustment, they are not going to stop serving victims, but they have had to back off on their ability to do outreach and public education. We want to make sure that there is service across the state of Minnesota, that all counties and reservations are served, and that the programs that are funded are able to sustain their capacity for providing these services. The cost of sexual violence cannot be ignored. Unaddressed trauma. So if a victim does not come to law enforcement or speak to family members or find support there and doesn't come to a program like our network of programs in Minnesota, the cost of that unaddressed trauma can carry on for years. It can affect future health, mental health, chemical issues. It creates challenges for individuals in their work, in life stability, and so forth. Offending behavior remains unaddressed and so forth. Sexual assault that is not addressed tears at the fabric of community. It fuels fear and isolation, and we see that happening currently. And our inability or reluctance to address it really supports the ongoing nature of this issue. I have a lot more that I'd like to say, but I'd actually like to invite Candy Harshner to speak on behalf of her program in Duluth. Thank you.
Ms. Dunn, Ms. Harshner, we're supposed to be out of here now, so if you could just try to limit your comments to a couple of minutes so we can adjourn on time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Donna Dunn is still dealing with a number of the services that, and the history of programs such as ours. PAVS began, as many other programs did 30 years ago, with a crisis hotline, and that service remains today. I would venture to say that everyone has been touched by sexual assault or is vulnerable to be affected by this crime. It's one of the most personally violent crimes that one can imagine, and when the victim is not adequately responded to, this crime can have a long-lasting and devastating impact on an individual. Because of the personal nature of sexual assault, victims are often hesitant to come forward. We may think we've come a long way because we've talked about rape for so long, but the reality for victims is that they're still not often believed or are blamed in some way for the crime which was committed against them. We believe it's our responsibility to access these victims in every way that we can, and we reach out to them in every avenue that we can, whether it's hospital emergency rooms, police interviews, or in a college classroom. We reach out so that victims will know that we're available to them. Being sexually assaulted increases a person's vulnerability to further victimization. You heard earlier about the young Hmong women who become victims and then, you know, we don't know what happens to them. One of our primary programs is to reach out to high-risk adolescents, the majority of whom have been abused and thus are much more vulnerable to further victimization. We find them through working in teen homeless shelters, at detention centers, treatment facilities, and in high school classrooms. There's no typical victim in sexual assault. We might respond to a 15-year-old girl who comes to a hospital after her first date, to a young college woman who is celebrating after having final exams, or a young professional woman who trusted her coworker for a ride home. Or we may respond to a middle-aged man who, for the first time in his life, is addressing the impact of child sexual abuse on his adult life. We do know that if victims can't find help, that they will suffer a variety of psychological or emotional problems, health problems, a lot of problems that affect us as a community and a society. This crime is not going away. If anything, we know that the more that we know about it, the more services we have to provide. And doing that in the present economic environment remains a challenge for us. And we consistently seek alternative sources of funding to support our work. Our program is supported through more than 53% of our funding comes from competitive grants from foundations. We advocate for victims of this crime, which means we need to work with them, with the people who care about them, and then the systems that get involved after a crime. We do this primarily through education, educating a police officer who thinks because a victim isn't crying that she's not in pain, educating an employer and helping them understand why an employee who was sexually harassed is afraid to come to work, educating the father of a rape victim so that he understands that threatening to beat up his daughter's perpetrator only makes things worse for her, and educating an emergency room doctor about the need to look a victim in the eye and say, "I'm really sorry about what happened to you. I'll make this as comfortable as I can." As advocates, it's our responsibility to help victims become survivors of sexual assault. by validating their experience, the feelings they have, and assisting them in navigating the systems that so often fail them. And then comes the most difficult piece of education for us, and that's helping the victim understand that because her case wasn't prosecuted or her perpetrator wasn't found guilty doesn't mean that she wasn't raped. It doesn't mean that people don't believe her. It only means that our system is flawed and that victims end up feeling blamed. The crime of sexual assault is alive and well. The goal of PAVSA and other agencies like the one that I'm in is to ensure that survivors of sexual violence survive this violent crime and thrive as well.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. I don't think we have time for questions, but we'll have you back when we look at your budget. Mr. Frost, I apologize, for we just ran out of time. We'll have you back and be first on the agenda. We'll notify you. Thank you, members. Unless there's no other business, this meeting's adjourned.